Part 9 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled The Magical Defeat of Evil.
I am sure that it will be understandable if the nature of a considerable context of human creation, but it assigns it not to human sin and disobedience, but rather to human ignorance and error. Ignorance, in Sanskrit called avidya, mistakes the phenomenal appearance of the world for reality, and thus the human soul becomes enmeshed in the world of change, tied to the wheel of birth and death from which it can be liberated only by disciplines of inner realization. You probably have come to already to the conclusion that this is, of course, a major, again, I don't like to use that word, but I use it just the same, a major paradigm in the spirituality of the East, particularly in Hinduism and in other traditions derived therefrom. It's really quite a sophisticated view. It's quite, in a sense, you might say it's quite a psychological view. Because what it says is that our wrongful understanding of what is real and our unfortunate ability to make and to be involved in sort of our own unreality, our own Maya, is the cause of the evil. So that we make the evil because we make an evil world for ourselves. No, I'm giving this a very psychological twist, but that is really at the back of it. It's quite sophisticated and I would say quite interesting. And that pretty much covers the five ways in which humanity tried to explain and tried to deal with evil. Now, I'll come to the particular mythos which has been used by my spiritual ancestors, the Gnostics, and will show you now for a minute how that fits into the picture. What we need to keep in mind is that the Gnostic thinking, and consequently much of Gnostic writing, as you certainly can prove to yourself by reading Nag Hammadi library or any other Gnostic sources, is primarily mythological. Now, if you don't feel very warm toward mythology, then you will not like that. But I think that kind of 19th century and early 20th century critique of mythology has pretty much gone by the wayside, where people thought that mythic thinking was a kind of archaic way of dealing with reality. That people would make up myths about the rising and the setting of the sun, or the growing of the vegetation, and things that you find in Fraser's Golden Bough, or things like that. It's a preposterous notion. Archaic people, so-called primitive people, simple people, are maybe simple, but they're not stupid. Not that kind of simple. They don't need to come up with a big, complex myth to explain to themselves how a grain falls into the ground and then grows into a stalk of wheat. It's nonsense. I lived among simple people in my childhood in Hungary and so forth, and they would have laughed you in the face. I mean, we know how that happens, you know. So why, then, is the presence, and I got to go quickly with this sort of thing, with myth so powerful at certain times in history, and maybe it's coming back to some degree, at least in some circles today. It's not at all because of what this kind of 19th century thinking made it out to be, but because there are some issues in life. There are some conundrums and perplexities and situations in life which cannot be profitably dealt with and understood, save by way of the myth. Well, you can deal with them by other means, but the mythic way is the most helpful. So you might say, where a sensate, a physical approach fails, where a logical mental approach fails. What is left is the mythical one. So when you see all sorts of teachers of spiritual things, in the Middle East or in India or in among the Sufis, which would be Middle East and ancient Judaism and so forth, when they, including of course the Bible, especially Jesus in his parables and so forth, they try to teach something of a very subtle, very other, very magical nature to people. Then how do they do that? They say, all right, my friend, let me tell you a story. You see? And somehow in the course of listening and apprehending that story, a little bit of a light begins to dawn in that dark head of ours. And at the end, people say, aha, I think I understand. But you see, it's not the kind of I understand that would come about as the result of a 1, 2, 3 reductionistic, logical, kind of quasi-scientific way of dealing with things. That's the trouble, incidentally, with much of this sort of 19th and early 20th century quasi-spirituality, occultism, and things like that, which to some degree, of course, has been inherited by the New Age, as I like to pronounce it sometimes, which makes a science out of something that ain't, if you don't mind me putting it that way. And then goes up or down the line. 1, 2, 3. Oh, there is a physical plane, and there is an astral plane, and there is a mental plane, and there is an airplane, and you know, blah, 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 all this sort of thing. Whenever this 1, 2, 3 kind of layer cake explanations come up, I begin to say, oh, oi, you know, because they break down. It is for the most part, it's an inappropriate approach to something. And the reason for it is that there is no real magical sense, magical thinking involved. For magical things, you don't need to think like a scientist or like an engineer. For magical things, you need to think like a poet. Because as Shakespeare says, the poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling. What is that? It's a change of consciousness. It's an altering of consciousness. It's the extraordinary consciousness which now addresses itself to the cognition of extraordinary things. Is this so doggone difficult to apprehend that ordinary things need an ordinary way to be understood? Extraordinary things need an extraordinary way to be understood. It should be simple, but we still don't do it. And part of that is, I think, that especially since the 18th century, maybe even a little bit earlier, it has been drummed into our heads culturally so much that poetry and art and these sorts of things are not truly real. It's nice for entertainment. But the real things are the ones that you can figure out mathematically and that you can somehow connect with sensate experience. See, prior to that, the attitude was exactly the reverse of that. Now, there is, for instance, a great deal of evidence indicating, and I can tell you the sources where you can find it, that the dramas of Shakespeare were not only inspired by, but, let's say, consciously saturated with Hermetic philosophy. You might almost say that somehow a decision was made somewhere that the Corpus Hermeticum and its teachings, which were brought to England at the time of the Renaissance by Giordano Bruno from Italy, need to be made available to people, and that the best way to make them available will be in the form of drama and of art, because that's how they work best. I am not one of the people who say that Francis Bacon or anybody else like that wrote Shakespeare. I couldn't care less. And you know what I found? Of course, you heard me say that before. Most of these people who will go on and on and on for years and for a lifetime trying to convince other people that Francis Bacon or somebody else, Lord this or that, wrote Shakespeare, or a committee of Elizabethan statesmen or somebody like that wrote Shakespeare, you know what? They hardly ever read Shakespeare, these people who say that. They don't know the Shakespearean corpus, because what excites them is the conspiracy theory. They couldn't care less about the dramas of Shakespeare. If they knew what Shakespeare really wrote, then they could see that there is a magnificent higher a spiritual didactic effort going on here. Now, how did I get to Shakespeare with all this? I don't know, but I think I'll be able to trace my steps back by some kind of thread of Ariadne. And the thread of Ariadne is the issue that there are some aspects of life that can be best approached by way of mythic and poetic modalities, because they are so different from the material and prosaic and logical intellectual categories in which our lower minds operate. And that is why the Gnostic approach to this, of the origin of evil, is also mythic. Now let me go very quickly with that. The whole issue is, and most of you know this and will consider it a redundancy, of course, is that the world of physicality and of psyche, that is, the world of body and of mind, within which we live and which lives in us, has been provided not by the ultimate reality, but by an intermediate power or demiurge, demiurgos, half-maker, which incidentally is a concept that goes back to Plato. Plato, in his work, The Laws, whatever that translates like into Greek, so not in the Timaeus, not in the others, says that, and I quote, that the universal God, that is not his word, but the ultimate God, the good, and now are the words of Plato himself, has appointed ministers to preside over the various functions of the cosmos, down to the last fraction of them with infinitesimal exactness. In other words, the lesser worlds have been fabricated, put together by lesser beings. These are demiurgoi. Now, this notion was well nigh universally held in classical antiquity. Moreover, it was not restricted to so-called pagans like Plato, but was in fact a prominent factor in so-called monotheistic religions up to a certain extent, such as Judaism and Zoroastrianism. How does it appear there? It appears by way of the angels. What are angels? Angels are messengers. In other words, this whole worlds and hierarchies of beings, and the further down they come, the more material and perhaps materialistic they are. Now, one of the inevitable consequences of the recognition that they are such intermediate creative and administrative agencies is the myth that declares that they are not all good and helpful, but that at least some of them may be unwise, unkind, and arrogant, and even some of them downright evil. Of course, the fall of the angels, of Lucifer, who was an archangel originally, the whole theology about the fallen angels has something to do with this. I don't want to go into it more and more, but let me just say that this, of course, appears all down the line, clear into the New Testament, and that is why the Gnostics had their own interpretation of this, where, for instance, in the Gospel of John, the 12th chapter, Jesus speaks of the demiurge, as far as I am concerned, when he says, "Now is the judgment of the world. Now shall the ruler of this world be cast out." Which, of course, means, and this is canonical gospel, that he comes and he is going to undo what the power that rules over this world has established. Similarly, many statements of St. Paul, the apostle, whom Elaine Pagels has properly called the Gnostic Paul in one of her books, indicate that he shared this view. So we find, for instance, at one point in the letter to the Galatians, where Paul writes, you are probably all familiar with this, "So when we were children, we were serving under the elemental powers of the world." When we grew up spiritually, then we didn't. And then the famous one from the sixth chapter of his letter to the Ephesians, "For we are wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the world of this darkness, against the spirits of wickedness in high places." So here then is the Gnostic view of the origin of evil. Now, all right. Now comes the big question that we were really supposed to talk about, and that means what to do about it. What is the magic then against evil and the defense against evil from Gnostic point of view? Now, we need to understand from a Gnostic perspective, which is really the perspective of classical antiquity, we live in three worlds, to wit, the material world, one; second, the psychic world, or the world of mind; and third, the world of spirit. The first two, namely the material world and the world of mind, are not evil. I repeat, not evil. But they are contaminated by evil. They are mixed with evil. Many, many statements of this exist, and an interesting mythologem in that regard, which appears in various ways, and certainly appears in the cosmological, cosmogonic myth of the Gnostic prophet Mani also, is the notion that somehow, at some point, the light has been swallowed up by the darkness. The good has been swallowed up by the bad. And from then on, the two were mixed. The two were coexistent in the same locale. It's in the Greek mythology where Dionysus, the god, is torn apart by the Titans, and then at some point that bubble. You see, once again, compassion, kindness, helpfulness, whatever you wish to call it, caritas, the charity, it's not just to be done because it's nice. The heck with nice. It's to be done because in addition to everything else, it's a stratagem to break out of the confinements of the ego. But the ego is tricky because it may, and it certainly does, mingle that very effort again with its own egotism. It's very difficult to escape a demiurge. So you try to be compassionate. You try to be good. I'm going to donate so many days or whatever to a charity. I'm going to be in the soup kitchen or whatever. But the little demiurge rides along with you to the soup kitchen, you know. And then what will he do? He'll pat you on the back and he'll say, "Oh, aren't we a good boy? We are doing something good. We are making the world a better place. And we are practicing compassion. We are being charitable. And consequently, aren't we wonderful?" You see? It'll do that. It'll do that. It'll do it every time. So one has to be extremely careful, and it requires a tremendous amount of self-observation, a great deal of self-reflection, inquiring into the depth of our motives. Is there self-seeking there or not? And another helpful thing with that is, in this respect, one thing that helps is the less abstraction you employ in your good deeds, in your good works, the more concrete there. You want to help somebody specific. You know? Now, of course, that's sometimes not easy to do. I don't have much, but I give money to good causes too, because they need that more than they could use my own bumbling efforts. You know, I don't know how to do anything that would really help these charitable causes. I would be a burden. They would have to kick me out or something. But be careful about causes. Be careful. Why? Because they are abstractions. And they themselves become an ego-feeding and an ego-building situation. Because, again, the thing will be, I am the guy who is involved in this good cause, you see. I am the one who helps the revolution in Timbuktu, which of course will probably bring a more malign dictator to the fore than the previous one, and so forth. But whatever the case may be, there is a great danger in abstract causes, because they automatically feed the ego, because where does an abstract cause exist? It doesn't exist in reality, otherwise it wouldn't be abstract, right? It would be concrete. An abstract cause exists in the mind. And the mind is a dangerous place. It's a dangerous agora. It's a dangerous plaza where all kinds of nasty things go on. And that is why the way to be compassionate, the way to be good, is in as direct a way as possible. And without the involvement in abstractions, in abstract causes that lend themselves again to the building of that ego. Now, I would be remiss if I omitted this at the last occasion. What about spiritual wickedness in high places? Or as some people translated, in the air, you know, aren't, what about demons? What about nasty things that are not physical and that are not necessarily in our egos? Don't they exist? Well, all I can say is there is evidence that they do exist. And if you look, for instance, into the Gnostic teachings of Valentinus and so forth, he even speaks of Satan in addition to the Demiurge. And in fact, he says that the satanic forces are worse than the Demiurge because they have not forgotten the real God, but they are against him. You know? Conscious antagonism toward the good. Well, with the Demiurge, it's only forgetful stupidity and arrogance. If you want to apply it to the individual, you can. The ego is not necessarily the worst thing that we have within our psyches. There are demons in our psyches. There are terrible things there, terrible possibilities, which are not just ego-driven, but heaven knows where they come from. Heaven knows how they fell from heaven. And all you need to do is look into the annals of crime, look into the Jeffrey Dahmers, look into some of the things that go on, or for that matter, on a massive scale, look into the Stalins and the Pol Pots and the Adolf Eichmanns and things like that. Is that just ego? Well, you know, Hitler certainly had a big ego, but there are other things going on, real nastiness, a real deep, dark evil that is very, very difficult to approach or to explain by any other means. And of course, against these, the two things that can be done with these things. When they haven't gotten very close to one yet, then one needs to defend oneself against them. How does one defend against them? By the cultivation of the sacred, the cultivation of the symbolic life, the cultivation of the divine. The more one has that, the less active they are. The less they will be able to get to you. I can't, and it's not my purpose to convince somebody who is not affinitized to certain symbols of the sacred that might be important and meaningful to me to adopt the same ones. They might not mean anything to that kind of a person. But something should be there. So one needs to think, what is the best symbolization of something good, of something wonderful that you can think of and that you may have? Maybe it's the picture of your mother. That can be a holy picture too. You know, it doesn't just have to be Blessed Virgin Mary or Mother Sophia. It could be your mother or whoever, but something. And have some center, some symbolization of the good of the sacred with you and around you in your place. If you move into a new room or things like that, don't go to sleep for one night without putting up something that is good and sacred to you, that is part of your, that relates to your inner life. Otherwise, take things with you of that sort when you are traveling. And then these things will be far less likely to come to you. There are, of course, even nastier things than that, and that's where exorcisms and things of that sort come in. You may say, oh dear, medieval awful stuff. Well, they are necessary. I've been just reading a rather interesting little book, if you come across it. You may not agree with a lot of theory in it, but it's very interesting. It's written by an Italian priest by the name of Gabriele Amorth, and it is entitled An Exorcist Tells His Story. Father Amorth is the officially appointed chief exorcist of the city and the diocese of Rome. And he has been working in that field for quite a number of years. He learned it from his predecessor, who was another priest who was the exorcist, and his experience is very, very extensive. And he makes a very good case that this sort of activity renders a very important service, and that it's most unfortunate in different places where the church is ever more reluctant to recognize these emergencies and to train and appoint exorcists, because there is a need for getting rid of unusual, certainly not frequent, manifestations of radical evil. And so that leaves us really sort of with our own condition. How are we to treat? How are we to defend ourselves? How are we to get rid of the darkness and the evil that is around us and that is within us? And there, I think, all kinds of approaches are being taken. We have to have our own. I will not condemn any approach, especially not an approach that works. I think it is quite useful that there are religious approaches to these matters which seem to work, and even though perhaps the theology behind them may not be to our liking, that they are quite helpful to people. But of course the question always arises, what of those for whom the light of that kind of faith has gone out, and for whom the simple answers don't work, and who have seen the contradictions in these structures and who cannot resolve them? What of them, and what of them indeed? Secondly, of course, there is also, let's say, the secular option. I think that is probably the most bereft of hope. Because the totally secular outlook that does not recognize anything beyond the rational and beyond the senses is simply not able to avail itself of an adequate defense against evil. The greatest evils that have come forth, at least on a grand collective scale, in our horrible, horrible 20th century, came out in a milieu and by way of people who had become very, very secular. Hitler and the Nazis. Hitler may have shouted about providence and things like that, but there was no transcendental orientation there. There was no contact of any kind. And of course, even more so with people like Stalin and Pol Pot and Mao Zedong. There is very little hope against evil, personal or collective, in those quarters. Also, I think there is not much good that comes out of the sort of vague, imprecise notions characterized by the fuzzy thinking, the denial of the darkness that masquerades as certain kinds of spirituality today. I think the New Age phenomenon is singularly vulnerable. And I don't say this for the same reasons that the fundamentalists might say so, but it's primarily vulnerable because it denies the existence and the power of evil. If you have a rattlesnake in your room and you deny that there is a rattlesnake, then the rattlesnake is much more likely to bite you than when you recognize that it is there. It's not to be done. Denial has not done away with any kind of an unpleasant condition. And so I think these things are very, very vulnerable for this reason. What the entire New Age phenomenon needs, I think, more than anything else, is a realistic recognition of the presence of evil and how to deal with it and how to counter it, which it really does not have. Now, I need to conclude by maybe giving you a little indication of what I would think is ultimately, and again sort of primarily at a semi-poetic level, the approach of Gnosis to these matters. What is needed is the magic of Gnosis. To break through the dark vault, the inverted bowl upon which are inscribed the lights, the planets, to say no to the darkness, to the enemy, and to renounce all his works and all his pomp and all his deception, his never-ending tricks and falsehoods. No, we shall shout. I wrote this a number of years ago. I say no to you and all that you stand for, and I call to my true parent, the one far away in the distance, the great alien light, the great love from beyond, the mighty one beyond all that sense can perceive or the mind can comprehend. I call to the other, the holy other, the one out there beyond earth and beyond sky, beyond the seas and beyond the vastness of space, the one without a second, the truth without falsehood, the love without guile and without condition, the one who hears and understands, the one who liberates with might and loves with freedom, the one who shall free me from the enemy, free me from all bondage, and help me to leave this house of nothingness. He is the one, the only one, and he is my help. It's kind of a little poetic statement. You may interpret it the way you wish. But I think somewhere along these lines lies the answer to Gnosis to these matters. And I thank you very much.
Copyright NMI by BC Recording. Catalog number 341409. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.